You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to a new episode of Delirious Nomads, brought to you by Blacklight Media Records, a weekly podcast hosted by yours truly, celebrity chef Chris Santos. I hate calling myself that. An underground metal connoisseur, Matt Bacon. He loves being called that. This is your new favorite podcast for all things heavy metal, as well as breakdowns of your favorite combat sports and riffing on some food talk every week with very special guests from across the globe.
Hello and welcome to the Delirious Nomads podcast. I'm your host, Matt Bacon. Chris is not here, but I promise you he will be back very soon. He's literally like filming stuff with Rachel Ray and stuff. Chris is wild. Anyway, I do have a very cool guest today, a very good friend of mine, someone who's been my friend for a really long time now.
Yeah, it's kind of weird.
How are you, Tom Haywood of Redefining Darkness? What's up?
What's up, man? What's up, everybody? Yeah, hopefully I can live up to Chris Santos, you know, filling in this little spot for the day. But we'll try to make it interesting, you know?
Yeah, so let's talk about this for a minute, because you obviously have an interesting background in the scene, right? Can you talk about that? Because obviously you have the label, but what came before the label? And then lead us into how that turned into the label.
Well, it depends how far you want to go back, you know, but I've always been obsessed with music, you know, since I was a kid. And then kind of probably the same story as most, you know, you hear that one band and it triggers all kind of stuff. And you start going down the rabbit hole and you're looking for more and more extreme. And, you know, so by the time you're a teenager, you know, start playing or start taking instruments more seriously, music more seriously than you used to, and kind of takes over your life. You know, when I graduated high school, I did like 2 years of community college, music focused, so taking a bunch of music courses and business and composition and stuff like that. And then I took 2 year break and I was still playing in bands like locally in the Cleveland area around that time. But then after that 2 year break, I realized that I needed something drastic to change. I needed to really pursue this thing if I really wanted to do it for the rest of my life. So I applied to go to Musicians Institute in Los Angeles. And so then I moved to LA with a friend of mine and went to PIT, which is the Percussion Institute, and graduated from there, you know, a year or two later. And so that kind of really catapulted the journey and like no turning back. Like, this is what I'm going to do one way or another. I'm going to make this my life in some way. So yeah, that's when I just like, I literally left everything. You know, I had a girlfriend at the time I'd been with for like 7 years or something. It was crazy. And I just was like, I got to go do this for my life. You know, I have to do this. I'm like 22 years old if I don't do it now. Like, so yeah, so I went to school. So LA was great. Met people from all over the world, because it's weird. Like Berkeley and Boston is like a more popular school here in the United States for music. And obviously the Collective's becoming a more popular school. It was pretty small back in like 2003 when I was going to MI. But MI is really popular in other countries like Japan and Sweden, actually, because there's another MI in Japan.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. We had a really mixed, diverse group of students there because of that. So it was like a third American, a third Japanese, a third Swedish, and then everything else mixed in, you know, Australia, people from all over. So it was just really cool to interact with those people. So most of my friends weren't from LA. They were actually from all over. So that was really cool. But then, yeah, just playing all the time. And that's why I chose Musicians Institute, was because like with Berkeley, it's like, you know, class, more classroom setting. And like, if you wanted to play, you'd have to like lug all your gear around all the time, or you had to, you know, I was a drummer. So, you know, of course it's like the worst thing to lug around. And you had these big lockers, and when you'd want to play, you'd have to break them out and go to, you know, room, whatever. I don't know if things have changed, but, in LA, you had your own like practice cubicle that you shared with somebody, and every room after hours turned into a practice room. So every classroom had basically everything you needed in it, and you had 24-hour access. So, I would play to like 2 a.m. Yeah, it's crazy. So I just dove in hard there. But yeah, so then after that, I did end up moving back home, because I kind of made myself an ultimatum. Like, if I can't get a job in music in LA before my time is up, I didn't want to get stuck having to like pay rent working in and out or something, you know, like I needed to get a gig.
Sure.
I kind of put myself in a timeline. Anyway, so I moved back home, kind of saved money and regroup. Moved to Cincinnati for a little while. Met my first wife there. Well, actually, I met her in Cleveland. Moved to Cincinnati with her just to kind of get a new perspective. And then I started auditioning. So it's funny, I auditioned for DieCast. If you remember DieCast in Massachusetts area. So that was like probably like 2004, 2005, maybe. And I think I was a runner-up for that gig. I had come out pretty early. They really liked me. And I know a couple of the guys were fighting for me to be in the band, but then some dude came down from Canada that they really, I think, blew him away. And so he ended up getting the gig, which worked out. And then Into Eternity, I actually auditioned for and got the gig, which was a Century Media band at the time. Dude, I had my whole life ready to move. Like, I had to take out a loan. My mom helped me take out a loan to, like, move to Saskatchewan, like, Canada, pretty much. Like, the week I was moving, Tim had hit me up, like, the week before I was moving, Tim hit me up. I'm like, hey, what day are you coming in? You're coming in this week? I'm like, no, it was next week. I'd given you all the information. Like, I needed to clear some stuff here before I came up, but I'll be there next week. And they're like, oh, well, Century wants like stuff like this week. I thought you were coming this week. And I was like, dude, I gave you all my details. So pretty much he was saying, well, they want us to get in the studio. And like, I'm just going to have our old drummer come in and play these tracks. And I was like, dude, I'm moving my whole life like this, and you're telling me now that I'm just gonna come up there and be some live guy, like, and I gotta live in your basement? And you know, it's so weird. So I didn't go because it got so weird. It like flipped in a second, which I'm sure happens in a lot of cases like this. Yeah. But when you're messing with people's lives like that, man, that's
terrifying, and it's hard. Yeah,
well, he wasn't thinking about that, you know. He was thinking about what he needed to do, which I understand. But I was like, dude, you got to understand where I'm coming from. Like, literally uprooting my whole life
to come be in a death metal band.
Yeah, right. So I didn't do that, which ended up working out good because obviously all the problems they've had, although I was a fan of them at the time. And then, just kept moving along, man. And then around 2006, 2007, I moved back up to Cleveland with the wife. We got married in like 2006. And, I had a friend get a gig with Abigail Williams. The friend I moved to LA.
Didn't we all?
Yeah, yeah. There's, that member list is like insane, man. It's like an encyclopedia of metal in its own right. But the friend that I moved out to LA with to go to school at MI, he was the one that got the drumming gig for Abigail. So he had flown out to Arizona where they were based, started doing the tour with them, which was Dark Funeral, Enslaved, and Abigail, which is an amazing tour. And, this was 06, still the end of 06. This was like fall, like right around this time probably. So he went out, and I wasn't familiar with Abigail Williams at the time. They just had that EP out. And to me, it was too newbie anyway. I wasn't interested, but I was interested in Dark Funeral and Enslaved. But I was happy for him, you know, and whatever. And as he got out there a week or two early, they started rehearsing, doing all that. And right as they were leaving for tour, their guitar player quit. So my best friend got the call back in Cleveland because of my other friend who was playing drums now. He's like the best guitarist musician I've ever met. My friend felt the same way. We call our dude Mike. So John was a drummer. Called my dude Mike, and Mike flew out. So I think that gets the old guitar player did like a couple dates, but then they had to fly Mike out to like Oklahoma. So Mike had like 3 days to learn the set. Flew to Oklahoma, came, you know, pretty much finished the tour. Cleveland was one of the last 4 or 5 dates. So I go to see my friends play, and Mike comes up to me and he's like, dude, they're like not happy with John, man. He's like not cutting it. They're going to like leave him in Cleveland, and they're going to have Zach Gibson, who I'm sure you're aware of from Black Dahlia Murder. He played on Miasma. He played in Phobia, all those bands, played in Abigail Williams. He's from Detroit. So it was just Zach was coming to the show in Cleveland. It was only a 2-hour drive, or whatever. And their plan was to leave John in Cleveland because it wasn't working out. He wasn't like cutting it. And Zach was going to finish the tour because there wasn't that many dates left. And so I was like, oh, shit, this is going to be like a messy night, you know? So I just stepped back, supported. John played that show, but then they left him there. And Abigail Williams broke up after that. So for people that don't know, Ken and Ashley were pretty much Abigail Williams. She was that original keyboard player. She's quite amazing, by the way. She went to school. And that band fizzled out. So I got a call from Mike, that guitar player who had gotten called in, right? He's my best friend. And he's like, I've been talking to Ken Sorceron, however you want to address Sorceron, who's pretty much Abigail, right? him and Mike still were in contact. So Ken had gone back to Phoenix, Mike was in Cleveland, and they had been writing back and forth, you know, internet, over the internet, whatever. But Abigail was dead at this point. So they were doing a new project, unnamed, and Mike recommended me to play drums. So then I sent some video rehearsals, and back then we had to do the camcorder thing because phones didn't have video yet, or at least sure. Most didn't. It's all still flip phones, so, and Bluetooth maybe. But yeah, so then I got the gig that way. And then, yeah, that was kind of the beginning of it. So that's a whole another story, man. But basically, that project got signed to Roadrunner. Mike Gitter was our A&R guy. It was called Born of Fire. You could find at least one track on YouTube, I'm sure, if you search Born of Fire. The song was Burning Bridges. That's the song that really got us signed. But it took us a while, man. They were recording us for a while. Gitter kept calling in on us, that kind of thing. And it was taking a really long time. And Gitter had recommended, because Abigail Williams kept getting tour offers, even though they were defunct. Him and Ked would talk, and Gitter was like, well, why don't you take this lineup and go out as Abigail Williams and just like see if this is working? He's like, you know, before we get in this whole Roadrunner mess, like, see if you even get along with these people, see if there's chemistry there. And
sure.
So Ken was like, well, look, I don't know if this thing's going to work out. So we got all these offers. Do you guys want to do this? So then, yeah, it just kind of started happening that way. So we did go out with Abigail Williams, but in the meantime, we did get signed as Born of Fire with Roadrunner. And then it just so happened that when Roadrunner was going to do their forecast, I think this was for year 2008, we didn't fit, basically. We were a brand new band. They had just signed us. They were signing Mutiny Within at that point too, I think. It was us and Mutiny Within. And originally called Mutiny. Yeah, they didn't have room for us because, you know, they got Slipknot records to worry about, Nickelback records to put all that money to. So they're like, well, we can either put out a record in 2009, which is a whole another year away, and we wouldn't be able to do anything. We just have to sit and wait. Or we'll release you and give you like $25,000. So we were like, we still got Abigail Williams to go out with. So let's just, you know, we owe a lot of money to our management. Let's like just say goodbye. So we did.
That's wild. That's like very of that time too.
Long story, but summed up quickly.
Yeah. And so then you leave Abigail Williams eventually.
Yeah. Yeah. So I stayed with them. So 2007 was the first tour we did, which is pretty wild because it was with Vader and Love and Creation and Cattle Decapitation. It was Veil of Maya's first tour. We were playing over them and Like This City. Yeah, it was a Death by Decibels tour. I don't know if that was the first one or not. They didn't do too many of those, I don't think, but that might have been the first one ever. I'm not sure. So that was cool for my first official, like, real tour, because I was a huge Vader fan growing up and Love and Creation. So I was, like, in heaven. I was actually playing bass for Abigail, because even though I went to school for percussion, I was never that. I mean, these dudes are playing, like, 16th notes at, like, 240 on, you know, double bass.
Yeah.
I was like, nowhere near that. Born of Fire was a lot more mid-paced, so I was playing drums for Born of Fire. But during that whole time I was explaining, we had a showcase that we were supposed to do for Roadrunner, kind of in the midst of all that early, like, courting that I was describing. And that week, we were real crazy then, man. I was working, me and Ken were both working at a club in Cleveland doing sound. And we just partied this one night, and we all hung out because we were going to the studio after. So basically, we would either work, or we would be at the studio writing songs to send to Roadrunner to see if, like, we can push it over the edge.
Right.
And we partied hard, man. We got drunk, and I kicked what I thought was a beer bottle on the ground, and it was like a street signpost that they had cut because they were doing construction on the street. And I destroyed my foot, dude. Like, I thought I broke my foot. And we were supposed to play, like, later that week. This was, like, probably a Sunday, and we were supposed to play, like, Thursday or Friday. So I couldn't even, like, walk. So we had to figure out something quick, and we didn't have a bass player. So I was like, look, dude, I'm not going to ruin this. You know, we've working so hard. I like don't want to be out of this. I'll do whatever I have to do to stay in this. I'll buy a bass rig. I'll play bass, because I've always played guitar and bass too. And like, let's just get Zach down and like do this for the showcase and all that. So that's kind of what we did. So that's how I ended up playing bass for Abigail.
That's cool. And then how did that turn into the label?
Yeah. So I toured with Abigail 2007, 2009. We were with TKO Bookings. For those who don't know, that's Ash Adelson, his booking company. So the owner of Sumerian, and he's doing a lot of big things now. Ash was actually our agent back then. Our manager was Jerry Club, which, if anyone's followed Jerry at all, it was literally the first two bands he had under his management wing were us and Suicide Silence. And Suicide Silence blew up, and Jerry got Winds of Plague, and Winds of Plague blew up. and you got like Memphis Mayfire and all these other bands, and they all blew up, and Abigail Williams was like the dark horse, you know, like we were like the shitty like stepson or something, you know. We just shit the bed every time. But yeah, so we had this with good crew, really, this good support, and got to the point as we kept going that Ash wasn't, you know, other bands were coming along, doing better. Ash wasn't really getting us good tours anymore. And so as we were kind of like figuring out what to do, we brought in John Finberg because he guaranteed.
Oh,
yeah, no, man, he was dead. He didn't have a good relationship with a lot of people, but he was really anti-TKO, and he was like, I'm going to book a tour that, you know, blow them out of the water, you know, whatever. So he booked this, it was Goat Whore, Abigail Williams, co-headlining, so they were like switching nights. Doth, who was on Roadrunner, and do you remember SWATs, Successful Right Apocalypse Across the Sky?
Yep.
And I want to say there was one more band on there, so it was actually a decent tour lineup, but because Finberg had this shit in his head, dude, this tour started at like 40, 42 dates, which is, you know, a substantial tour. It turned into 72, dude, by the end.
Oh, Jesus. Okay.
So that was kind of going to be my last tour. It was just, you know, I'd been married for a while. We had one kid already. We had another kid come in and, you know, I had a house already. And,
yeah,
you know how it is, dude. I come off tour and I barely have money. So I would work. You know, luckily I had these odd jobs I can go back to, and I'd make as much money as I could. And when I'd leave for tour, I would basically give the wife all the money she'd need while I'd be gone, as far as for rent and my portion and all that. And sure. I would leave, but I'd already had a kid at that point. So I was missing the kid's life. It wasn't really going in as quickly as I wanted to in the direction I was hoping, money wise. And so, you know, I just had to make a life decision. So I was like, okay, well, I'll do this one last tour. It'll be cool. You know, basically our first bus tour, co-headlining Goat Whore. This is going to be fun last tour. And as those dates kept going up and up and up, I'm like, dude, I can't be gone for that long and not come back with like $1,500. You know, like I'll be like dead by the time I get back. You know, I won't have a house. So I exited. I was like, I have to go, man. Like it's just not going to work out for me. So it was bittersweet because, you know, it wasn't anything bad. Like we had a good relationship. I think the band was, you know, still doing well. We were kind of trying to figure out our next steps. Like I said, the TKO thing wasn't working out and just trying to figure out where to go next. But yeah, it's just life. So that was the end of that, man.
And so then how do you start redefining darkness?
So yeah, so got home, tried to get the life together. Still wanted to make my music my life. So I was doing sound at the club, and which was great because bands that would come in, you know, that I toured with or been friends with, it was like reunions all the time, you know. It was just like running into all your friends, and so that was actually really fun. But I still had a family, man, so I was working like super late, obviously doing these shows, running sound, mostly monitors, and I was teaching music. I taught music for like 8 years at a conservatory, teaching percussion.
That's cool.
Started like a rock school for kids and shit. Yeah, so I was doing a bunch of odd jobs as a musician, as most musicians probably do, just to get by and whatnot. But yeah, me and the wife didn't work out, so you know, I had to go through divorce there, and, you know, that's never easy, even though it was kind of mutual. And I had to kind of get my life together. So I actually took a break from all music from like 2010 to like 2014, maybe, dude. Like,
oh, wow. So like right when I met you.
Maybe it was 2012, 2014. It was about a two and a half year period where I had to like just leave, because for me, music is, I liken it to like an abusive relationship, and it's my own fault. But it's like I'm so obsessed and so driven that like I let it take over everything in my life. And when the divorce happened and I had to kind of look at my life and go, okay, what am I doing with my life? I got kids, I got two babies, and my ex now worked a day job. And because I worked all nights and crazy hours and stuff, I was like the stay-home parent Monday through Friday in the daytime. So I actually got to be with my daughters like all the time. So it was like, well. And I got offers, dude. I don't know if you know Eighth Day Sound.
Yeah.
They have office in Cleveland and New York and London and, you know, all over the world. And they do sound for like Madonna and Jay-Z and all that, right? I had a friend who got a job there. He's like, dude, you want to work for Eighth Day? Like, I can get you in. And I was like, man, that would be amazing. But then I had to think, like, I would never see my kids. I'd be home like two, maybe 3 months out of the year. And I wouldn't know my kids at all. So as tempting as that was to continue to make music my life, I kind of proud of myself that I stepped away from that offer. And, you know, I just took a took a road that I didn't necessarily want to take, but I felt like was important when you take the selfishness out of it, you know. But anyway, music had been abusive. I'd let it become abusive, almost like a drug addiction or something, where I really needed an extreme.
Sure. And that's like a really hard thing that people don't really know how to deal with.
Yeah, dude. I was like seriously driven and obsessed with it because it just consumes everything, you know. I let it do that.
So then the label starts out of that.
Yeah, so once I got stability, so obviously it takes time to like figure yourself out, right? So I did some therapy just to figure out like, okay, well, what happened in this marriage and why didn't it work, and you know, what was my part in it, and what, you know, how can I make myself better? So I went to therapy for a little while to the point where I felt good, where I felt like I could step away. So, you know, you deep dive into yourself and you see things that you didn't see before and all that kind of stuff. So it was really great. But then you kind of know when you're done, you know, and or at least I did. And so I did that for maybe a year. And then, you know, just got time to be comfortable with myself. You know, I had the house. She didn't want the house. So I got the house and had my kids all the time and just figuring out like, what's next? What do I do with my life and get comfortable with myself? And I was still listening to music, but I was like allowing myself to. You're like a different generation, man. Like I envy your generation because you guys are a lot more open. But my generation, I was at the tail end of like those tape trader dudes. And like, those are the guys I looked up to growing up.
Sure.
And they're like, they tend to be super elitist, you know? Whereas like, if you don't like this, or if you like that album from that band, you're a poser, you know? Where it's like, it's kind of fucked up, you know? So you kind of have that back in the back of your head, even though it's bullshit. Like you think about that and it affects your decision sometimes, which is kind of stupid. Yeah. But when you grow up that way, it kind of lingers. So I loved all kinds of music. I obviously went to school for music and I never had a problem admitting to stuff. But at the same time, that kind of feeling lingers, which is kind of like a weird thing to explain for people that don't understand that. But I really started diving into other music. So I took all the passion that I had for metal, because I was always looking for the newest thing and finding the most extreme stuff. That whole time I was playing in bands and growing, I mean, literally from probably 10, 12 years old all the way through Abigail Williams. And I stopped the metal thing and walked away and started like digging into indie and R&B and like all this other stuff of like exploring with the same fervor and passion that I would with metal, but like in more positive things. And like, it really just like calmed me out, man. And like I discovered a lot of cool stuff, and it was just a nice break from all the doom and gloom. And I think it just helped get me in a different headspace, man. And then once I got comfortable with myself, I met my current wife.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was going good. And then once we were kind of together a while and things kind of like righted, and, you know, I was becoming a better person and a better man and a better father and a better companion and all these things. Once all those things started to happen and line up, then I started feeling comfortable again to step back into that space, because I never left like the friends, right? The only friends that I left behind as I was like self-examining was like all the friends that were like energy vampires and like dramatic and suckers of the soul. I realized that during therapy, I'm like, I got to get away from these people, you know, people that are very like self-serving friendship, where they're like always like dumping their problems on you, but you're never talking to them about your problems. It's not like a true friendship. It's just like them, like, you know, after you get off the phone, you're just like, oh my God, like,
yeah, like, what am I fucking doing talking to this guy?
Yeah, and you feel bad because you've known him forever, you're your friends, but I had to cut off ties to some of them, and that really helped too. So like I said, I had to kind of extreme cut off kind of the metal stuff for a while. It wasn't like I didn't listen to any, but I wasn't like exploring and diving in as I had been before. Going back to maybe some old stuff here and there, but yeah, man. So once everything started going right and I was getting on a really good track, I started feeling comfortable enough to kind of like let the guard down, and like, because the love was always there, the passion for extreme music especially is always there. And I started kind of like doing this again, and you know, and I had friends that were doing new projects, and I was keeping in touch with everybody, and so my foot was always like in the crack of the door, you know.
Sure.
And the one thing I hadn't done, because I had toured obviously as a musician, I tour managed while I was on tour, I'd done sound at a club, you know, I've kind of done all these different roles, and I'd never been on the business end or the promotion end or the label end. I didn't really understand much about it other than what I experienced on the musician side. So I was like, well, you know what, I have all these friends, I'm like, everyone comes to me for new music. Like, I'm the one that's showing everybody, like, check out this band. So I already do all that work anyway. But it started with writing, actually. It you know, through just like social media and talking to people and networking, I met a guy who ran a site called All About the Rock in the UK, and he needed.
Okay, I remember that site.
Yeah, they did a pretty good job, and they needed writers. And I was like, you know what? I'm not a good writer necessarily, but I listen to a shit ton of music. So I give you my opinion, and I've been listening to this music my whole life. So they were cool with it. And obviously, I was interested in my background and stuff. And so I started writing for them and doing reviews. And that's when everything started to kind of come together. And I'd done a couple podcast interviews then for them that I ended up turning into my own podcast, which is that Into the Darkness podcast. The first couple were like James Murphy, who's a long friend of mine now, and Gregor McIntyre.
Oh, really? Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, yeah. It's all available and up. But that was a really good one. Gregor McIntosh from Paradise Lost, who one of my favorite bands of all time. That was set up by them, so that was cool. And Trevor, actually, I think, was like my first official podcast. I'm going, okay, I'm going to make this my own rather than doing it for them. Like, I really enjoy doing this. So I reached out to Trevor, and he did that for me. So he was like the third one, or officially like the first Into the Darkness podcast.
That's wild.
Yeah, but then that turned into the label thing, you know, with everything that was going on. Just like I told you, it was kind of like, I do this anyway out of the love for searching it out. I have all these friends in the industry. They're all in different bands now, or they have a side project. Why don't I just try to release it, you know? So that's that.
And so then what I wanted to kind of get into here was like, you know, the death metal scene is kind of in the best place it's been in a very long time right now.
Yeah.
And you kind of witnessed that development firsthand. Why do you think it is in such a good place?
Yeah, it's hard to say like exactly, you know, the reason. But, you know, these things do happen in cycles. I do believe that. And it's not the type of secular relationship that I think people want to believe, like, oh, the 60s style dress rotates now. And like this, I don't think it's that like crystal clear. I think it just comes in these bizarre overlapping cycles. And, you know, obviously the last one was in like late 80s, early 90s. And I guess it's just the time, but I think it takes new blood to have these things happen. And so you had a bunch of hardcore kids get into death metal, basically, is what happened. Yeah. And instead of, you know, there's a lot of dudes, the old me would have definitely been like, fuck off. Like, this is our style. Like, you can't have it, you know? That's that elitist mentality that I was talking about. But it was cool. It was cool and refreshing to hear that different spin. And one of the first bands that I heard, and again, this was me like doing what I did, searching out new music. Bandcamp was kind of this new thing around, well, this was like, what, 2014, 2013, 2012, maybe something like that, when I started getting back into everything. So Bandcamp was this kind of new, fresh thing. And I would just go down these rabbit holes. And
yeah,
I found that band, found this band from Toledo, Mutilatred.
Yeah.
Cause it started. So yeah, they started in like 2013, 2014. So it would have been right then. They had this like 2-song demo or something. And I was like, holy shit, this is like Mortician, but like real instruments and a little slower and just completely crushing. And I'm like, I've never heard anything like this. So it was kind of a cool take on, you know, these kids kind of discovering death metal and doing their version of it, basically, you know, and truly getting into it. These weren't just dudes hopping on some bandwagon, because there was no bandwagon at that time. These were just dudes that were like, wow, I've never heard anything like this before. I was listening to all these Victory bands or whatever. And now, like, I heard, I don't know, Defeated Sanity for the first time, and it blew my mind and, you know, started doing this stuff. So I heard Mutilatred and was blown away. And then obviously Gate Creeper came around the same time. So it's just cool to hear these fresh takes and going kind of back to this primitive way of, ironically, how thrash turned into death metal. Now we were having like hardcore's turn to get into death metal, which is kind of like a weird dichotomy, you know, but it worked. I mean, it got oversaturated, just like it got oversaturated in the 90s, but we're still kind of riding this thing. And I think because people are staying open and they're letting it evolve on its own, you know, I think some of it's totally overdone, right? I mean, there's just so many bands. Like, you can't possibly know them all anymore because of where we are with technology and everyone to be able to record themselves and like all these things. Like, it is an intense and overwhelming environment. But for anyone who's interested in it and new, it's like,
it's exciting. It's fun.
Yeah, it's like euphoric. It's almost like having every drug available to you. And you could just grab it and go, you know, it's like all this amazing music. and you can filter through the stuff you don't like, but there's always going to be something you can find that you like. So that part's still exciting. And I like that, that kind of like exploratory, like adventure and kind of like finding this stuff is fun to me.
Yeah. It's like this baseball card collector mentality, right?
Yeah. Yeah, totally, man. And I think a lot of metal fans feel that way. So,
yeah. And so that's cool. And then like, what do you feel the successes of the label or what do you think set the label apart?
I don't know. It's hard to kind of self-examine, you know, but
sure.
I think the fact that I had some connection at the beginning definitely helped me.
Sure.
I tried to use it to my advantage a little bit. I wasn't trying to like name drop and stuff, but it was like, hey, just an introduction basically of like, hey, I just started these new labels. I used to do this, you know, I'd appreciate any help or assistance or
your whatever. Yeah.
Can I send you promos or, you know, whatever, like the stuff that you preach of like, just network, just introduce yourself. Like don't ask for favors, but like,
just say hi,
just say hi, let them know what you're doing. You know, build some rapport. So I started doing that. And I did some research too, obviously. And, you know, I don't know if people know, but I have two different labels and that was very strategic. And, you know, I looked at kind of what was going on at the time and Dark Descent was really on the rise at that time. They were just blowing up, kind of like we saw with Maggot Stomp in the last like 2 years. Like that was happening for Dark Descent at the time, like lightning fast growth. And I was like, man, everything they're releasing is like exactly the same. And then I started noticing all those Stoner Doom labels, like the Ripples and Easy Rider or all those. And they were so specific and niche. And remember, I had left the scene for a little while. So when I came back in, I'm like, oh, this is like different. This is like a boutique scene. Like,
yeah,
this is like specified for your taste, you know? It was almost like, yeah, like a drug boutique, like in the Netherlands or something. Like, hey, you like this? Come here. And we have this for you. And it's all this. So I thought that was interesting. So I started doing more and more research and I was like, well, you know what? I'll try that. Fuck it. Like if that's going to catapult what I'm doing, let's experiment. So I love obviously extreme music and love death and black metal. I was like, okay, well, I'll do one imprint just solely into that. Like if it's evil, that'll be here. But I love so much music that, you know, I wanted another outlet to be able to support bands that I truly loved. And so that's why Seeing Red exists, you know?
Right.
And if you look at the trajectory, my theory kind of proved right. The more niche, the faster it grows is because you have this built-in audience of like, if this audience liked that last release and this release pretty much in the same exact vein, they're probably going to like this one.
Yeah. And then you kind of get like consistent followers or whatever.
Yeah. You get this built-in fan base almost. Yeah. It's kind of interesting. Kind of sucks for Seeing Red, which is more of like a traditional label, right? You got bands that are kind of all over the board and a lot of great bands, but they don't tie into each other, you know. It doesn't have that same effect. So but yeah, so that's kind of how I think that's what catapulted me, is just kind of using that, you know, what I had kind of seen happening in the scene.
Mm-hmm.
and using that to catapult it. But then just like maybe the quality of bands, you know, and again, dude, like you don't know when you hear a band, like if people are going to respond to it like it did to you. But all I was doing was being a fan and picking bands I wanted to work with based on, I love their sound. Like literally it was all it was based on. Now that I've been in it for a long time, now I'm looking for other things, right? That make more business more successful. Like, are they touring? Like, yeah. How active can they be? Have they built their own fan base? Are they putting the effort in? Before it was just like music only. And let's worry about the rest later, you know, but you have to evolve with that stuff. So
that's really cool.
I don't know if that answered the question, but
for sure. And then, so now the label's kind of, what's happening now? Where do you see it going? Where do you see the death metal scene in general going now?
It's hard to say, man. Like I said, it's getting overcrowded. So I'm curious to see like when the bubble will break or like what the next trend is. And people are trying to, just like people try to like forecast like the finance sector, you know, oh, what's happening with real estate, what's happening with crypto, what's, you know, no one fucking knows. And you just have to like take the best educated guess. But it, to me, with music, it's almost like, who cares? Like, let's go on the journey. Like, now as a business person, you're thinking like, I want to be ahead of it, but at the same time, that's not like why I got into this. So to me, I think I just got to be true to myself and keep it organic and like just like let the, you know, if I hear a band I love, like support them. You know, like, so
yeah,
I don't know where it's going to go. I mean, I don't have that crystal ball. I'm hearing so much cool music and I'm hearing some like industrial stuff coming back, like kind of this almost with the same vibe it came in like the late 80s, early 90s. I don't know if that's going to take off or not. I have no idea, dude. It seemed like a few bands popped up in like the more extreme metal side of the last couple of years that sound like just like Godflesh, and that was it. There's only these couple bands. So maybe that's not going to happen, but who knows? I just hope people keep pushing the boundaries, man. Like that band Worm. I don't know if you're familiar with that band Worm. I think they're on 20 Buck.
Yeah, but, they're great.
They're probably one of the more interesting bands that I've heard combining all styles and doing it in a way that makes sense, where it's not like, I use Between the Buried and Me as an example. I hated that band when they came out because it was this like pick and choose your style, you know, like cut and paste. We're going to have death metal part. We're going to have black metal part. We're going to have this kind of proggy part. And we're just going to cut and paste. And obviously they evolved. But at the beginning, I was like, this is horseshit. Like, I don't want to hear this. This is not musical. But they had to start somewhere, I guess. But Worm is like combining it all seamlessly, man. And like, to me, if I had to say there's a future in extreme music, it's got to be that. It's got to be the way Worm's doing it, where they're just kind of like taking all of this and like, you can't categorize this as a death metal band. We're not a black metal band. We're not a doom band. We like are an extreme metal band.
Yeah.
Just letting the music flow from us. And this is what's coming out.
Heavy and evil and terrifying.
Yeah. And in Imperial Triumphant's another one. I know they don't. It was like crazy to see their rise, dude. Like, I loved it, but.
And you signed them, right? You gave them their first shot.
No. I mean, they had already been on that Italian label, Code 666, and done a couple things. I literally only did an EP. I just think we did such a good job on the promotion side. And we did have some help. Me and a guy I haven't talked to for a long time. I don't even know. I think he's out of the industry completely. But we kind of just really dove in and got a lot of good press for them. And, you know, they did a lot of work on their own. Those guys worked so hard. So they deserve all the success. They've done everything right, really. But to hear that kind of music, like, resonate with people is, like, insane. I mean, it's like John Zorn.
Yeah, because they're just so intense and weird and unapologetic.
Well, and it's, like, not digestible. That music is uncomfortable to listen to. A lot of it's just noise and, like, jazz on steroids with these kind of, like, black metal-ish. I mean, I don't even think there's much black metal left in there. It's just like this extreme music assault. Because I've had all these death metal guys interested in it, right? And like, they'll come to me and be like, you released that Imperial Triumphant, right? I'm like, yeah. They're good friends of mine. I love them. And they're like, dude, I had to like walk up out of the room. Like, it was like, I don't get it. I thought it was terrible. And I was like, but you know, it's like some of those dudes just don't get it. They're death metal heads or black metal heads, you know, but like, I'm a musician first, so like it always, you know, resonated with me. But it's so crazy to see their success, man. So who knows where it's gonna go, man? You got bands like Imperial pushing it, bands like Worm pushing it. So it's exciting to hear bands like that.
Mm-hmm.
People, you know, even like I'm gonna butcher it, man. I don't know Latin, but Lingua Ignota or whatever, that chick.
Lingua Ignota.
It's insanely cool, dude, and it's so deeply personal to her, and she's like revealing it all. And it's some of the most extreme, intense shit I've ever heard, you know? So, I mean, that to me is more extreme than a lot of like heavy music. I mean, it's way heavier. So,
sure. So the future is bright is what you're saying.
I think so, man. I think there's going to be a lot of shit in between because there are people that just fall on the bandwagon and maybe not even by choice. Maybe they just heard it too late and they started a band. And, you know, for all of the amazing bands, there's like 20 times the not so great bands, right? And so it will kind of filter its way out, all the shit. But and there'll still always be bands jumping on bandwagons and stuff, but for the people that are kind of like torch bearing and striving to have their own sound and their own voice and do something different, that's what is interesting to me. And I think, you know, the labels that I look to and respect the most aren't ever signing bandwagon bands, dude. And that's like 20 Buck Spin and Profound Lore. Like, I always look to them when I go like, you know, what would they do in this situation? Like, they just always have stayed true to themselves and they're successful because of it. And they just sign bands they believe in. And that's like literally the same ethos I try to live by, whatever, you know?
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on and kind of getting so deep into the backstory and unveiling the depths of, the depths of depravity.
Yeah, man. I hope I didn't bore anybody. I know I can trail on with some of that stuff. There's just so much.
Yeah, it was cool.
That happened. You know? It's hard to sum up sometimes.
Absolutely. Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on. And thank you everyone for listening. And we'll be back next week.
All right, guys.
All right. So that was awesome. Thank you everyone out there for listening to Delirious Nomads, sponsored by Blacklight Media. We will be coming back at you next week with another awesome guest. Be sure to follow Blacklight Media on socials for new music and more, and above all, keep it heavy.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you'd cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room?
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Frates from The Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective. The only podcast you crank up to 11.
I don't think it overstates things to say that the Beatles were the greatest gift to entertainment and culture of our time, a secular religion, if you will, with their universal appeal and demonstrable impact on people's lives. I'm Robert Rodriguez, host of Something About the Beatles. With every episode, I speak with historians, musicians, artists, and Beatle witnesses, all in the service of fresh insights into the most joyous cultural entity the world has ever known. I hope you'll join me and listen to Something About the Beatles, now on Evergreen, and wherever you get your podcasts.